Sahana bhavatu, sahana punaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Expand on or describe what are the subjective problems that go away for a jnani vis the objective problems that remain for us belonging to Ishvara that you touched on in this afternoon's talk. Yeah. Well, they say, for instance, just by taking this birth, or this human birth, that to take a birth on this loka, where you have free will, you know, and they say that this particular loka, which is right in the middle of all of the other lokas going up and going down, that it's 50-50. I mean, part it's 50% comprised of 50% of your sanchitta punya karmas and 50% of the papa karmas, and those situations are taking place in real time, in Bhagavan's time, not in subjective time, or not in the subjective, it's not a dream state that I have some control over, it's not an imaginal space that I have control over, it's Ishvara space. So it enjoys the manifestation of those punya and papa situations enjoy the same level of reality as this body-mind-sense organs does. And so it's not something... the way that the creation is or the situations that come my way are not something that I can wish away, you know. Like you can do that subjectively if you have an imagination or emotion or a bad dream, you can at least wake up from it and it's not there. It's all subjective. Pratibhasika. I mean, it doesn't have any substance compared to this, which I can't just wish away, you know. And so... whether I have knowledge, self-knowledge or not, this creation goes on unfolding and my prarabdha goes on unfolding, and not all of it is meant to be exactly what I was hoping for it to be. So there's some papa karma that's exhausting there that creates difficult situations. Those difficult situations are not just going to go away. However, they'll be there, they'll manifest, but my response to them will be different. You know, and my response, way I respond to Bhagavan or to the events that take place, I have some control over, you know. And your knowledge, your self-knowledge significantly changes the way you respond to the world, because now it's really not about your raga dveshas. You know, it's about just doing what is to be done in the situation. I'm not even thinking about it making me happy or sad. I'm just here responding to the prarabdha karma with that prasada buddhi or that ishwararpana buddhi, where I just see everything as Bhagavan and I do my best in the situation. And so even though if I were a samsari, if I didn't have self-knowledge, then I would be controlled really by these raga dveshas. I want, because my happiness is at stake. And so that's what drops off. It's not like the situations all of a sudden, you know, because you're a jnani now, Bhagavan is blessing you with good situations. Nope. Not true. It'll just be, what? But you may not even respond to them as being difficult situations for you, because you don't need them to be in a particular way. And so that really balances out. That summit to a buddhi just remains the same. What throws off the summit to a buddhi is raga-dvesha. I need by raga-dvesha I mean the binding raga-dveshas. That's what throws off that shanti, or just being with myself, appreciating Ishvara. So there's Ishvara has a lot of, you know, sometimes Swamiji calls it salt and pepper. You know, with the creation, it's not just bland. It's not bland. And it's not ice cream either. It's a mix of everything. The experiences are many and varied, and the kind of the emotional tone of the experiences are many and varied also. But that's fine with me. I don't have a problem with that, because I'm not asking them to be in a certain way. So that's the wonderful thing. That's the real freedom. Why is it not appropriate to swim in the Ganga? Do the sannyasis let the family know about his or her renunciation? I think it's just not appropriate because it's considered a very sacred river. It's a river where people, they'll take water out of the Ganga and save it for years. It does. I don't know if this is still true because there's so much pollution, but for many years, and even when I was in India in the early 70s, that Ganga water was very pure, and it would not go bad. It always maintained its purity. And so people would always take water, like jars of water, out of the Ganga and save them, give them to people, use them for pujas, you know, use them to bless you or to bless others. And then people would take a dip in the Ganga where they would totally dunk, put their heads all dunk completely underwater and jump up just for the blessing of the sacred water. And so then when they see people like swimming and playing in it, it's not meant for that. It's meant as something, you know, that's very auspicious and sacred, where you're treating it in that way, not as a regular river. So I've seen, it's kind of shocking for Indians when Westerners who don't have any idea about that are just swimming around and playing and, you know, playing tag and whatnot. It's just a shock, because they would never do that in the river. So we have to learn all of these things. You know, you have to learn about the culture and what the people are sensitive to, and just how any culture is like that. You know, you have to, because certain things, especially in an Eastern culture, you have no idea about some of the protocols and things. So it's usually we try to, when a Westerner comes, like I know at the ashram, when a Westerner comes who hasn't been to India or doesn't have any idea, we always kind of tell them, teach them, so they don't feel embarrassed or humiliated, you know, by doing something that is never done. Yeah. So. Does the sannyasi let the family know about his or her renunciation? Yeah. They usually will let them know and ask permission, the blessings of the family also, though they don't need the blessings of the family to take sannyasi, but just as a courtesy, they'll always tell, and they'll also ask for the blessings. And usually, often, the parents are very reluctant to give those blessings. And so a lot of times Swamiji would kind of step in, and there would be a lot of discussion, you know, and to make the parents feel safe and comfortable with their child, especially if it's a woman taking sannyasa, you know, who's going to take care of her, and, you know, how is she going to, she can't just wander around in India, you know, who will look after her, and all those type of things. It can be difficult for some parents. So I know in Swamiji's case, he'll always step in, and if the parents object too much, then you usually tell the person you just wait for a while. I know some women, sannyasinis that were close to me even before they took sannyasa, that they had to wait for a while until the parents could handle it. So just out of respect for the parents, you know, it's kind of like, what does it matter? I can be without wearing orange for some more time for their sake. So they do tell. No grandchildren. Who's going to take care of us when we're old? How will you be taken care of? We'll look after you. All of these things are big, kind of big words. It's another pretty one. Since we are eternal and nothing really happens when our body dies, since we don't hurt other people except for the sorrow they might feel, what does the Vedanta stand about committing suicide? Is it adharmic? Is it papa? Is it simply one's inability to still appreciate life and Ishvara Srishti? Well, I think there's some really positive, what I consider very positive news on that, because I did talk to Swamiji about that many years ago, and I don't remember how it came up, but it was in reference to if a person is terminally ill and doesn't have much longer and knows no quality of life, and so that they're going to die. The Manusmriti, the Dharma Shastra, says under those conditions, when the person is terminal and there's no quality of life, then it's fine for them to take their own life. And in fact, some Swamiji told me some instances of the Swamis, the sannyasis, when they become like they're living on the banks of the Ganga and they really are just taking care of themselves and they're living in their little hut. And there comes a time when they're really too old to manage for themselves and they might be alone, you know, whatever. And they can't function well at all anymore. So they will just walk into the Ganga and let the Ganga take them down. The Ganga way, when you higher up you go, the Ganga is freezing. It's kind of like the water in Norway, you know. Absolutely cold it is. Like it couldn't be more cold without freezing. So the water, as you go up higher, the water is fresh. It used to be fresh and cold like that, and they would just enter in and get that hypothermia, whatever you call it, and just be washed away down at the Ganga. And that was, I would say, just absolutely acceptable. You know, they were a bother, they couldn't manage anymore, and so moksha, like that. So they don't have the big curse on it. However, if you're healthy and you're not terminal, you're healthy, then that's looked at as a papa, not something you should do. Kind of like in the West. On the other hand, it's not black and white. Like for instance, if a person suffers from what we call clinical depression, when they're in that depressed state, the suicide rate for somebody who's in a depressed state like that is very high. And there's reasons for that, because in that deep depression, you cannot see out of it. You're in tremendous pain. It's like being held deeply underwater. And if you look into the future, you're unable to see anything but that, which is one of the actual symptoms of clinical depression. Everybody gets depressed, but they get depressed, and they're depressed for a while, and then they're not depressed. Clinical depression is much more severe than that, you know. And then a person may feel, I can't go on, you know. In schizophrenia also, there's a very high rate of suicide, because even though it can be somewhat controlled by medications, the person's feeling is, because of that illness, they're thinking out of the illness, because the illness is so pervasive, I can't go on, and they find and they kill themselves, but they're not killing themselves. The depression is killing themselves, is killing them. The schizophrenia is killing them, you know, because even the buddhi doesn't have any freedom. It's totally overwhelmed by the emotional state, which is actually chemically induced, you know. So you can't make a judgment on another person, like whether why are they going to hell because they committed suicide, you know. That's probably not, because I don't know, I couldn't say, but I would say probably not. Why would they? Because you think they're committing a murder on themselves. They're in so much pain that they can't make a rational decision, you know. And even when they're in so much pain, they have to have certain external conditions that can make them endure that pain. Like, my child wouldn't be able to survive if I did that. Or my family would be in so much grief, I can't do it to them. But when the depression or the schizophrenia or whatever is too much, they can't even think about that. It's too much. And so then you can't say that they killed themselves. The depression killed them, and schizophrenia killed them. It was too much to bear for the buddhi. So I don't think it's something we can make any decision on other than just compassion, because people don't just walk around and kill themselves for no reason. It has to be pretty, pretty severe, intolerable pain. With no hope, this is the thing, intolerable pain with no hope of it lifting. That's what happens in depression and also in delusional disorders and schizophrenia, but especially in depression. No hope and intolerable pain. Because we can stand intolerable pain and all of that if it's going to lift, if you're going to get out of it. But in depression, the depression won't let you think that you're going to get out of it. That's part of one of the worst symptoms of the depression. You just feel like you're trapped forever.
What's the manu
supposed to be? Manu is in the Dharma Shastra. There's like something like 8 manus. You can look it up. You know, you have to really look this up. But they're the Dharmanishtas who have, what is the Dharma of this yuga? What is the Dharma for our era? And so you can I've even read it, actually. They have them available, and you can just read through. They have English translations. It's kind of hard to understand some of it, you know. But it's just laying out what is Dharma, what is a Dharma with these situations and this situation. So it's a guide.
Is it part of the Vedas?
It's attached to the Vedas. And it's like called a Shastra or I think it's called an Upanga. Different than a Shastra. Yeah. What does prevent us from naturally accepting differences of people's thoughts and behaviors? What's the nature of the desire that people and situations be as I want them to be? You know, it's a lot easier to accept the differences in people and in their thoughts and behaviors, their culture, even Republicans versus Democrats, you know, they're so opposite. They're like from totally different tribes, you know, but they don't necessarily take away your shantavritti, even though definitely, you know, there's a non-binding dvesha they have for each other, you know. The non-binding, but binding dvesha also. I know people because most of my friends are Democrats, so they'll have like a binding desire, dvesha, the dvesha for these people who think like this, because they see it so evil and so dark and so detrimental to the world. You know, they're like the evildoers of the world. And so they'll have, they become, they're very political people, and they really rile up around all of that. So, but I would say if the people are unknown to you, and we're just talking one-on-one type of thing, they're not really known to you, and they're not really in your circle, and you don't have a personal relationship with them, then their issues and problems or whatever it may be are probably don't really affect you at all. In fact, you can be really compassionate and helpful, and if they come to talk to you, like say when I had my therapy practice, and a lot of people would come, and they would be talking about all of their issues, and some of them were very difficult, but it was no problem because it wasn't personally directed. But something happens when you can say, if you have a friend or somebody who's within, you know, close to you, you may have experienced them having tremendous, you know, anger and hatred and projections, all this really intensely on someone. You experience them acting like that, but you've never experienced them having that on you. And that is a whole different thing. So we're able to accept people as they are much more easily unless they're directing their hatred or their anger or their criticism onto us. So that is a whole different feeling. And we don't tend to like to be criticized. You know, or to be criticized or disliked or the object of somebody's, you know, wrath or hatred or jealousy or all of these things. It's very difficult to take that. You know, and so then this binding, non-binding desire becomes, you know, it's more of an accomplishment to have you can really wish that that whole situation was not happening, or that that person even didn't exist would be better, you know, because it's too intense, it's too much, and they're too much into your space. And so to be able to let a person like that, who's directing their wrath and anger and jealousy and hatred on you, to give them the space to exist, and to keep them, like Swamiji will say, you have to keep them outside. To keep them outside, you know, to give them their own space, to keep them outside. That takes a lot of maturity. I had a lot of trouble for that. It was many years before I could actually do that. They would go right inside. And he was, keep everybody outside. And they would just go, pew! Right deeply inside, you know. And then give them their own space and all this. Your whole psyche has to become, your own personal sense of well-being has to become very much more mature to have these, you know, non-binding desires for intense negative feelings when they're directed your way. It's really easy to have them when they're not directed toward you, to be caring and compassionate and try to be helpful. But when it's directed toward you, it's different, you know. So you have to work on it. And you do have to work on it too, because those are the things that happen that throw you off. You know, there's actually, if you think about it, you look at your own life, you could write it, you know, you might have five things that are really real raga dveshas for you, binding desires for you. You might probably don't even have five. You can list them out on half a piece of paper. That's what's causing you all the trouble. Not the billion things that are not causing you any trouble at all. There's billions of, how many experiences have you had? And out of all of those experiences, just this small handful is causing you a lot of pain. But those are the ones we have to take seriously and work with, because those are the ones that are hurting me. Most situations don't hurt us at all. They actually don't matter. You can be a really loving, good person when those things aren't there. So what does prevent us from naturally accepting differences of people's thoughts and behaviors? It's again, it's only if for some reason it's hurting me. Usually it's not. But if it is, then there's going to be some sort of raga dvesha that I not be hurt by that person. You know? What I want? What do I want? I want that person not to hurt me. You know? I want them to go away, or whatever. You have to look inside yourself and see what you want. But where it'll probably end up is, I want to be big enough so that that person can be as they are and doesn't bother me. I think that's what we really want. But in kind of a more, less mature level is, I want them to disappear, or I want them to go away, or I want them to change. I want them to change and start to be nice to me. That's a very, very, I'd say that's a very, very immature or very immature level, because then that's, you're then dependent. You're dependent on the creation somehow changing so that you can be happy. And we find out that's not a good bet at all. You know, so we have to become bigger than, like Swamiji says, your heart has to be as big as Ishwara's. Then no problem.
Yeah. What about sacred boundaries towards those people?
About what?
Towards those people, you have like a little bit. You can have an open heart and let everything come, or have a little bit setting a little bit boundary.
Well, keeping them outside is a good boundary. You know, because you're open-hearted. Sometimes we confuse being open-hearted with the inability to say no. You know, because you can be very open-hearted. Like I always use Swamiji as my example because he's such a master of this. So open-hearted, so loving. And yet he has no trouble saying no, you know. And because he has no trouble saying no, nobody takes it as though it's an attack on them. It's just that, you know, we can't do that in this situation, or that's not going to work in this situation, or I'm not able to do that for you. Let's see what else we can do. Where there's a love and there's an openness, but there's still keeping them outside and not letting them cross over into areas that you don't really want them to go, you know? So that's learning how to lovingly say no. And I think, yeah, but I mean, that took me quite some time to learn. I don't think I'm a master of anything, but I have learned along the way, you know. And that was a big one, to realize that you can, that it's fine to lovingly say no, because if you aren't able to do that, which there was a time when I really wasn't able to do that, what happens is pressure builds, and pressure builds, and pressure builds, and then an angry no comes out. And the only reason that angry no comes out is because you were unable to say no when the problem first started, because you didn't know how to lovingly say no. Does that make sense? Yeah. It's a big... It makes such a difference in your life, speaking personally, to really learn that, how to do that. Because then you don't find yourself getting angry or being curt or impatient, you know. The reason you get curt or impatient or rude or kind of, you know, mean or whatever is because pressure's been building up, because you weren't able to say no in the first place, you know, so.
Radha, could you please share some thoughts around how to be able to say no in a loving way without...
I'll tell you, yeah, it's not how you say it, it's how you're feeling inside. Because say you're all tense inside, and then you say, no, I can't. Yeah. Can't fake it. So learning, you know, learning how to say these things before that pressure has built up, you know, so that you feel fine inside. You have shanti inside. If you have, whatever you have inside is what the other person feels. No matter what you're saying, you know. It's like, I forget how this little phrase goes, that when Larry Jaffe, when Jungian analyst I was working with many years ago, he wrote it. It said something like, and he quoted it from somebody else, something like, "Your feelings are so loud, I can't hear what you're saying." Something like, it was a little better than that, but it was good. Yeah. We're very sensitive to other people's feelings. Yeah. Oh, would you like to talk a little bit about how to handle what comes up in meditation, stored feelings, memory flashes, etc.? Yeah. Good. So now with the work that you're doing, you know, especially when we're going in and doing the inner child work and also relaxing our body, relaxing our mind, invoking that inner friend, Even as I start to recognize my being as really the source of ananda, where I really start to understand that, you know, there's a tremendous relief for the psyche. You can even feel it for many people, like when you're first being exposed to Vedanta, and you're seeing it for the first time and understanding. It's as though somebody's finally saying what you've always known but have never known but have always known. It's just kind of an uncanny type of feeling. But that causes a different level of relaxation than you've ever had before. It's much different than even some sort of a sukhavritti or some joy or anything. For us, if you don't have self-knowledge, that's always has tension behind it because you know it won't last. So it's never just it doesn't have that kind of depth of relaxation that starts to take place when you're starting to gain knowledge, and then also then we go in and do this type of inner work. Then what we can find happening is we'll get, you know, these kshayas. Kshayas are the unconscious material that's really kind of stored in the unconscious, and the unconscious, as we say, is kind of stored in the body. So this deeper relaxation starts to take place. And what you'll experience is sometimes torrents of unconscious material thoughts that don't have really anything to do with today or no associative thinking, nothing. It's just torrents of thoughts and feelings and images flying up, you know, just flying up through your mind. And so what to do with those? Well, first thing is to know that it's actually a good thing, you know, because there's a lot of relief and release taking place that lightens the load of your unconscious, and it lightens the load of your defense system, and it gives you, takes a lot of what we call libido, psychic energy, to hold all of those things down. And it's like holding all of these things and bubbles underwater that all they want to do is come up. But you won't let them up because the defense system says, no, they're down there for a reason. And they're going to stay there forever. That's my job. But then we start, you know, having a relationship with that, and my body and mind are relaxing more because of my knowledge. And so these things come up. So what we have to do is welcome them and say, I'm glad you're coming. Because even though it can be kind of intense with feelings and emotions and thoughts and images just flowing up, you also you can also kind of intuit or feel that this is really something good. Because it's releasing a lot of stuff that's stored. And so what will happen is you'll have all the big waves of thoughts coming up. You should just welcome them. You don't have to even worry about engaging in them. You just let them come, you know, come and go. Because you can't really, it's hard when you're having a big bunch of them come, you don't even have time to pick one to deal with them. So you're just okay. You let them come, relax. And then that'll settle. And then you'll be going on and doing your work and doing your inner child work and doing all the stuff that we're doing and gaining knowledge. And then the next layer will come up. So that type of thing will go on for some time. There is an end to it. You know, it doesn't take that long, really, for those pockets to exhaust. So maybe, especially once they start, maybe it goes on for a few months or a year or whatever. But it's not for a long time. You know, it's for some time, not a long time. Then that pressure is more or less released, that really intense pressure that's stored in the psyche that you didn't even know about. You know? And then it's just much easier. That inner child work still goes on. You're still, you know, working with your raga dveshas and neutralizing your, learning how to neutralize your projections on other people. You know, all of these, we just keep working away at that until, in the way that you're learning right now, this is how we do it. It really does work. It just is something that has to become natural to you. And even that work, like right now, you may be spending a good part, like it will take 15 or 20 minutes out of the meditation. It could even be longer than that. It could be the whole meditation. It could be the whole meditation for months, in fact, for some people. But we're spending 15 or 20 minutes doing that and then shifting a little bit. But there'll come a time when instead of 15 or 20 minutes, it might be 30 seconds. Because you will have that ongoing relationship. That work is always being done. Now you're just starting it, and so all the little ones have something to say, and all the stuff that they're carrying, and you know, then I don't really, and all of these reactions I have toward these people and that people, those people, that all kind of gets settled, and then you know how to be with those things as they occur. And so then when you check in, there may be something, there may not be. If there's something, then you work on it. If there's not anything, you're fine. Doesn't, you know. But even while you're walking around, you know, if there's some little one or there's some emotion that happens, then you're just with it right then and there. You know, because that's how you are with your emotions. That's how you are with your reactions. You are with them. You're not projecting them. You know, if you are projecting them, then you'll be drawing them back and working on them after that projection kind of settles down. So, that makes sense? I think one of the main things is to know this happens and that it's normal and natural and good. And what I used to say and what I experienced is, you know, you have the baseline between the conscious mind and the unconscious. There's this baseline of some sort of shanti. And that baseline kind of sinks down. And the shanti is more, because less pressure underneath. And so it just keeps sinking down, and you have just more natural sense of well-being. Deeper, fuller sense of well-being, because it's not, this pressure from underneath is not there. You're lessening all the time. It makes a difference just for your your ongoing sense of well-being. And that's just from doing this inner work. The other side of that is we can do much more, this inner work much, much more deeply than perhaps you can if you're just in therapy, just because of the inviolate nature of yourself, and that the ananda is not something that anybody can do about. Nobody can hurt you. Nobody can hurt your ananda. Nothing is going to change it. So, and you are, your being is actually what is the healing force. Who you are is the healing force of all of this work that we do. And nobody can take that away. The work can't take it away. The little children can't take it away. Another person can't take it away. And you can't take it away from yourself. So it's, nothing can be done. And so that gives a huge amount of trust. You know, because nothing's going to happen to me. That makes a big difference too. But also just to know, like when these gusher, like a gusher of these thoughts come shooting up, and you think, wow, what's going on? What's happening? What's happening to me? You should know it's good. It's no problem. Just relax and let it come and go. Feel lucky. I used to feel really happy. It's like another layer is being released. So. Yeah.
What if you could talk a little bit more about how the Ananda of myself is the source of the healing? Is that, did I understand it right?
Because, well, that's going almost to the cliche that love heals everything. You know, even Freud, in one book that I forget the name of it, but it's kind of, it was actually a book written by one of his disciples, and he was quoting Freud saying, at the bottom of the whole therapeutic process is just wanting to be loved, feeling loved. That's what everybody wants. And so the source of that love and that being loved is yourself. There, it's not anything outside of it here. It's just a projection. You think it's coming from out here because you've projected onto your loved one, or you've projected onto your therapist or onto your teacher, you know. But actually, that's just a projection. That lovedness is your own being. And so because we know that and are getting more and more in touch with that, that also provides such a... it's kind of like a fail-safe. I have everything that I need for these little ones and for these issues that I have and these hurts and some of these, you know, very gruesome things that may have happened in our past, different levels of abuse and all of this that have happened, you know. There's different kinds of abuse. There's not only just there's sexual abuse, there's physical abuse, there is emotional abuse, there is verbal abuse. These are all listed as the types of abuse that people suffer from their, usually from their family situation, you know, because in the family situation the persona is gone and everybody's just being whatever they are and whatever temper they have or whatever, it's just wow, there it is. But it can be hard, you know. Verbal abuse is not an easy thing either. Verbal abuse is a type of emotional abuse. I mean, words, what's that, you know? I mean, words can really hurt you. Can really, really hurt you. It's a type of emotional abuse. Physical, sometimes emotional abuse is worse than physical abuse, you know, because it goes so much into your psyche. It is, well, it is in the end the only source of healing, but say if you're in a beautiful relationship, for instance, or you have a good therapist, or you have a child, and so with that child, some of the things that you didn't get as a child, you end up naturally, this is all Bhagavan, you naturally give to your child all the things that you didn't get. You know, you just naturally gravitate to that. And when you do, as you're doing that, that little child, you know, as you projected on it, the little you is projected on it, just automatically, and then you're giving that little child all of the things that you didn't get. So both your little child is doing well, and you, your psyche is also doing well. You know, so so we have so many ways in the creation that this projection of Ananda can then become back to me in a healing way. But the love that you experience is never out there. You can say this person is giving me that love, you know. But the love I don't see out there, you know, kind of making its way over to me. The love is my own being, you know. And that's what we discover in Vedanta, how all of that works and everything. But it's not to say that in the world, you know, particular relationships aren't instrumental in giving me that mind, that deep shanti that allows for that expression of love in my mind. Because the relationship with others can give the very, very deep shantivritti, where I feel deep love. The only thing is that deep love is coming from my being. And there's many ways to get that shantavritti, but until I have knowledge, I don't really know that. So I'm dependent on others for that shantavritti, or on situations, you know. And so then those people and those situations that can provide that for me are very, very dear to me, because they're as though giving me myself. But you wouldn't think of it that way. You'd think that they really love you, and so you feel loved. And that feeling loved is healing. Yeah. I'm putting this in the wrong.
Can I ask one more?
Yes.
Because the shanta with you, like you say, is so healing, but then I think there's also sometimes going into the hard emotions and really feeling them and expressing them is also so healing, and that's not really a shanta.
Yes, it is, in this way. When you're going into those emotions, the buddhi who's going into them has the shantavritti. And so when we're, that's why this inner work is so healing, because what happens is I'm able to differentiate, the buddhi is able to divide itself so that it becomes the knower and the hurt becomes the known. I come into relationship with the hurt, but the buddhi itself is without that, means that then it's just enjoying my own self, because I've objectified the hurt and now I'm going into help. So whether, even if I go into the unconscious, that's what I'm doing. That's what the inner friend is. As soon as I bring in the inner friend, then that inner friend has the Atma, the Satchitananda, me, as its self. And everything else, all the emotions and everything, have been objectified, so then myself can hold that painful emotion or whatever it is, or little one inside. You see what I mean? So, otherwise, it would be an angry, and I'm just making this up, but like an angry, mistrustful, you know, bitter, vritti going into, come into relationship with the hurt little child. That angry mistrust, if there's an angry, mistrustful, bitter part, then the buddhi has to come into relationship with that, so that there's a shantavritti going in to dialogue with that hurt part. I mean, angry, bitter, all that's just hurt. Everything boils down to hurt and not feeling loved. It's the bottom line. You don't feel loved. You don't feel wanted. And that just creates the most explosive reactions, internal reactions to those feelings, because it's totally against our nature. So it's as though I feel totally isolated from my being, so I'm not there. But couldn't be worse. Can't even say it couldn't be worse. Oh yeah, could if you were dead. No, because if you're dead, you'll still be having all this stuff. There isn't any dead. Can you please talk more about how lack of antakarana shuddhi adhikarityam keeps Ajnani from enjoying the fruits of the knowledge? There's two things here. For Ajnani, if that antakarana shuddhi isn't there, that means there's raga dvesha. Just that's the bottom line. There's raga binding desires that are causing all kinds of agitation and distress in the mind. So in spite of your knowledge, these antakarana, these binding raga-dveshas have not yet been dealt with, or maybe some of them are deep-rooted also, you know, even unspoken, like the traumas of childhood and those type of things create a mind that has stress and unhappiness in it. So that mind is not itself able really to enjoy a shantavritti, because of so many agitations in that mind, because of maybe abuse when you're young and all kinds of things, or just growing up with attitudes that are not conducive. The way you treat others, the way you handle others, like people who grow up in a more violent, criminal-like homes, mafia-type homes, are very rough, very, very mean and rough people. Say you grow up in a home like that where you see that your parents are not only mean and rough and horrible to you, they're mean and rough and horrible to other people also. Very angry and very bitter and all that kind of stuff. So a little child growing up in that is not going to have very good samskaras, you know. And so there's a lot of work, a lot of transformative work Value of Values. It's a book that I usually give to all my students at CIS. It's a beautiful. Just to gain the proper values so that they're not continually isolating themselves from, you know. So these things, all of these things take some time. What was the question? I lost it. No, seriously, what was it? You all lost it too. What?
The question?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. So that there's many reasons for the mind itself to have, you know, binding raga dvesha and also lack of values. And so it's just in spite of, because of Swamiji's grace or the teacher's grace to give you a shantavritti and pour that knowledge in, you have a lot of obstacles to having the shantavritti yourself, you know, just because of your lack of values. However, if you do know yourself, just the Atma, you probably don't have a good understanding of Ishwara, because that's a little, requires more. But if you have differentiated yourself, your own nature is not covered by a vritti. It's not covering. You don't look at a vritti as like putting a bag over the self. It does not cover yourself at all. And so there are two experiences simultaneously. One is the self-evident, self-shining experience of my being. Not subject-object, just self-evident. Like a light is self-evident. You don't need to bring in another light. Okay. So my own being, the ananda and the wholeness of me, is ever-present. It does not matter what the vritti is. And so if you say that a jnani, a person who I really know myself, then that is differentiated and is there present to the negative vrittis. So I have kind of the stability of me, my own being, which is self-evident and known, not as an object, but self-shining and known, recognized, and then the pain in the mind. You know. So on the one hand, I'm free from the standpoint of myself. I am free. But from the standpoint of the vritti, there's no enjoyment of that freedom. The enjoyment of the freedom is only from the self itself, its own self-shining nature. But the vrittis have a lot, there's a lot of work has to be done to straighten out that mind and to get all of those values. So it depends. People come to this knowledge, you know, with different handicaps, with different things that they're having to carry. And it's not that usual. You don't see that many cases where a person who comes to this knowledge has come from such a dark, abusive background that they themselves are abusive. We all have some abuse of some sort in our background because human beings are human beings. But most of us, that abuse has not been such that it takes away my kind of good personness. You know, my care and wanting to help, and he's just in kind of the normal human range of good personness. Whereas there's some, once in a while somebody comes who really wants this knowledge and is serious about it. But they've come from a background where that good personness is not there. In fact, there's a lot of aggression, you know. And so people just kind of tiptoe around that person, you know. And they're part of your group or whatever, but you tiptoe around because they're violent. And so they really, really suffer. Really suffer. And it's not it's a long haul to work through those type of wounds, you know. But most of us, we suffer, but we're not violent. We're nonviolent sufferers. That's better for everybody else. It's better for you, it's better for everybody else. Because the isolation that comes from that type of rage and anger is really really excruciatingly painful for people who have that. But nobody has that for no reason. It's depends on what type of environment. You have to say, so well, that was my karma to be born in that situation. You know, but now I've got to work my way out of it. For all of it, I mean, our life is our karma, after all. You know, there can be abuse of free will by people and all of that, but the best thing is to just, you know, you have to transform whatever your karma is into a way where you're not acting it out, but you're giving what you didn't get. Like Swamiji taught me that once in his own personal life, because he lost his father when he was 8 years old. His father died, you know, and so he didn't get a lot of attention because the mother had 4 kids, and you know, it was just he didn't get that. But he discovered at kind of a younger age that you get it by giving it. You think that you're dependent on somebody to give these things to you. But actually, when you give something, you're also receiving it. Like for instance, if you're being kind to someone, you yourself are experiencing that kindness. If you're being compassionate to somebody, you're experiencing the compassion. If you're loving to someone, you experience the love. So you actually experience yourself whatever it is that you give. And so conversely, if you hate somebody, you experience the hate. If you're bitter towards somebody, you experience the bitterness. If you're angry, you experience the anger. You know, so we actually immediately kind of get what we give. And he discovered that, and he told me that, and many, many years ago, maybe 30 years ago or so, you never have to worry about what you get. You just give it and you have it. You have it by giving it. And I remember it struck me as so, so real, you know. And that it's not something, at least for me, I hadn't really realized it in that way until he said it. And then if you start thinking about it, everything that you give, especially on an emotional level, you get it immediately. That's such a beautiful thing. So. Is this our last one? Or did I do it? Are the rituals made when taking sannyas a different one? No, the sannyasa ritual is between the Vividisha sannyasa and Vidvat sannyasa. No, the sannyasa ritual is the same for everybody who takes the sannyasa. Unless you give it to yourself, which that's you can do, but then if you give it to yourself, you're allowed to do that. I think you just declare before the gods that you're taking sannyasa. So, but then you have it ratified later. If you don't get killed because of apat sannyasa, sometimes you do it for yourself because you're in a dangerous situation. So you can just make that vow. But then you would get it done properly by your guru, and then it's just the regular rituals that everybody goes through. I'm almost positive of that. Yeah. Oops. It's this one. Oh, okay. No, okay. This one is nice about the Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. I'm going to save that for tomorrow.
Swasti prajapyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah gopramanebhya shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Deshoyam shobarahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve santu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pasyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhak bhavet Asato ma satkamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om